Good afternoon. How's everybody today? It's a Sunday, and it is time for Dr. Keisha Ross, New Horizons. We've got a great show for you this afternoon, folks. I hope you're going to stick around, enjoy what we've got going on here, New Horizons with Dr. Keisha Ross. Good afternoon, Dr. Keisha Ross.
Good afternoon, Ms. Williams. Thank you so much for the intro, and hello to everyone, and welcome to New Horizon, the mind and body connection on Intentional Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Keisha Ross, and today we have a special guest, attorney Sarah Johnson. I'll just let you know a little bit about Ms. Johnson's background, and then we will get right into it. Sarah Johnson is the Director of Juvenile Defense and Policy for the Missouri Public Defender System, where she also serves as the Specialty Practices Director, overseeing the Capital Appellate PCR, CDU, and Juvenile Units. In 2019, Sarah helped open the Children's Defense Team in St. Louis and Kansas City, a specialized team of lawyers in MSPD who represent children in Missouri. Sarah is a recipient of the 2013 Lon O'Hocker Award and MSPD's 2020 Defender of Distinction. Sarah is on the board of NJDC Central Region and is on Missouri's Juvenile Justice Advisory Board. She lives in St. Louis with her family and loves traveling, exploring outdoors, and being with family. Thank you so much for being here, Ms. Johnson. How are you today?
Hi, Dr. Ross. I'm so good. Thanks for letting me join also.
Well, we have a very interesting show today. We've had previous guests to discuss mental health and topics including stress, trauma, race-based stress and trauma, as well as mental and physical health disparities and advocating for equitable health treatment. So while we always have a thread of mental health, today we want to do something a little bit different and add another variable or element, which will be criminal justice. So today we're going to talk about the intersection of mental health with criminal justice. And Ms. Johnson will talk to us about her work as an attorney working with juvenile clients. So let's get right into it. Educate us a little bit. Tell us about the Juvenile Children's Defense Team.
Thank you so much. Sure, Keisha. So here's a little bit of a basic. So we practice in Missouri in the Children's Defense Team, and we have two units. So we have one in Kansas City and one in St. Louis. And we have two units and we have specialized lawyers because we know that children are different. I'm sure many people out there have brothers and sisters that they watched grow up or have children themselves or nieces and nephews. And we know that kids' brains are different. And so we have this specialized group of lawyers because they recognize that when we have a young person that we're representing, we need to take into account very specific things about that young person's age, their brain development, where they are in school. And so these lawyers need to be specialized, not just in criminal law, because Dr. Ross, we are representing young people who are charged with criminal offenses in the juvenile system, but they also need to understand school-based law. They need to understand mental health law. They need to understand special education law, working with the care and protection system. A lot of young people that we represent have been in foster care. So juvenile defense, it's just this amazing conglomeration of lots of different types of law. So we've got a group of folks who are really excited to do that work.
Wonderful. And all of those specialties that you mentioned, well needed. And part of what I want to talk about before you answer our next question is what we call adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs for short. So for those in the mental health area, pediatrics, or the law are familiar with ACEs for short. So adverse childhood experiences can include physical abuse, sexual abuse, physical neglect, emotional abuse, parental separation, household violence, community violence, household mental illness, household substance use, incarceration, or a household member being incarcerated, death of a loved one or caregiver. So there's a large spectrum in terms of what is considered adverse childhood experience. So it's not only what the child may experience themselves, it's also what they observe and witness. And why today's show is so important is that 93% of juveniles entering the justice system has had at least one adverse childhood experience. And over 50% of juveniles have had at least six or more adverse childhood experiences. So that will lead us into your talking with us about why do we need lawyers and psychologists working together?
So that's a really great segue. So you talked about ACEs, Dr. Ross, and, you know, as a lawyer, I worked with both adults and now my primary work is with young people. And so often a judge or a teacher or someone will say, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with your behavior? And instead of the question that we should be asking, which is what has happened to you? So many of the young people that we work with have been in and have lived through experiences that many of us have not had to live through. I've had so many young people as clients who have seen a loved one be shot and killed or a neighbor be shot and killed. Hearing gunshots at night is not an uncommon experience. Not being able to have food, not an uncommon experience. And so what do all these things mean in the context of the juvenile system? Well, it's really important when we are in front of the court and when we are developing the defense or the story for a young person that we understand what's going on in their brain. So we've got two kind of components. And the first component, Dr. Ross, you know, is the adolescent brain development, right? It's yes. The normal, everyday things that teenagers go through, right? Everyone yes. can go back and think like, what stupid thing did we do, right? And then it's the thing that we work with you as an expert on, which is talk to us and help us understand the trauma, maybe the neglect, the intergenerational trauma, and the adolescent brain development, and how do those things combine? And maybe do they provide a defense for a young person because of all of these things happening in their brain and all of the traumas that they've experienced? Does that provide us a defense? Or is that something mitigating where we can say to a judge, hey, judge, here are some services that this young person needs. And I've got a suggestion. I've got a therapist that would be willing to work with this young person. So it really helps to tell the story of that young person, which is so important in the juvenile work.
So definitely building that narrative, as you said, the story. And I love what you just said in terms of not what is wrong with you. Instead, you should be saying what happened. And that's trauma-informed care within itself, recognizing that trauma is so prevalent around among many of the children and the youth, the adolescent that you serve. What I also want to highlight with ACEs is that the prevalence of ACE is highest among Black youth, who make up a majority of those in the juvenile system. And after Black youth, we have brown youth or the Latin community. So going through the juvenile justice process of itself too is an adverse childhood experience. You know, sometimes there might be that stereotype belief like, oh, well, they did something wrong, so they need to be incarcerated. That's where they need to be. But not recognizing that for many young people, they have never been incarcerated, and it's traumatizing. If they already have a history of physical abuse or sexual abuse and they have to be strip searched, that can be triggering for them. If they have to be in, you know, detention centers where they have full grown adults, we have to think about that too in terms of how it can be intimidating. So the incarceration process within itself is also an adverse childhood experience. And that's what I really want listeners to understand too. So you talked with us about why it's important for lawyers and psychologists to work together. Can you give us a few more specific examples in terms of how you utilize psychologists, maybe therapeutic versus like psychological evaluation, assessment, your testimony? How do you utilize psychologists?
Absolutely. And Keisha and Dr. Ross, just to layer on your ACEs is COVID, right? So not only do you have a young person going into a detention center, but you have a young person who then might not be able to see their family because of COVID restrictions. So many of the young people that we have represented during this pandemic were not able to see their parents in person. And so then you've got that extra layer of just not making contact with family or friends or people that you love. So that, you know, that's an added, I think, ACEs that we didn't anticipate we would probably ever have to deal with.
Pandemic.
Yes, exactly. So talking about experts, you know, we've used experts, psychologists, psychiatrists in our work in a number of different ways. And I think the very biggest umbrella that I can think about, and for us, the most important is for a certification hearing. So this is a hearing in juvenile court where The offense is oftentimes very serious, and the juvenile prosecutor, they call them legal officers, is saying to the judge, hey, judge, we don't think this young person is appropriate for the juvenile system. We want to send them to the adult system. And so it's our job under Missouri law. There's 10 factors that the judge has to look at and make that decision. So it's our job, Dr. Ross, to help convince the court this young person deserves to stay in the juvenile system. And so we often partner with psychologists who do evaluations of the young person. They do evaluations to assess their mental state, right? Do they have a learning disability? Do they have any other significant mental health impairments that might be mitigating to the court? We also use psychologists to outline adolescent brain development. So we know that teenagers have more impulsivity, less ability to say no to their friends, which we can all attest to probably when we were teenagers, and a lack of ability to foresee the long-term consequences of their actions. And all of these things seem kind of basic, but when you're in a courtroom and when you're in front of a judge and you've got really serious charges, it's always really important to remind the judge, hey, judge, this is a young person that's sitting next to us. Particularly, Dr. Ross, and I know, I'm sure you know the studies, but they say that young Black boys are perceived to be between 3 and 4 years older than they actually are, right? Yes. So when you're looking at that young person in the courtroom, we want the judge to remember, hey, judge, this is a 13-year-old, 14-year-old child. They still deserve to be in the system. So that's the one. That's one case is, you know, certification hearings. We're trying to keep them in the juvenile system. Another way we use psychologists, psychiatrists, is when we don't believe a young person understands what's happening in their case. Sometimes it's just because of their age. We've had really, really young children, 10, 11, 12 year olds, who just don't understand that I'm a lawyer and that I'm trying to help them. They're the ones who are in charge. They don't understand that, hey, the judge is the one who makes the decisions. The prosecutor is the one who has to put on the evidence. And so we can use them to the psychologist to say, hey, judge, this young person doesn't understand what's happening. The second scenario is when a kid has significant mental health impairment. So maybe a learning disability or maybe some sort of undiagnosed or diagnosed mental health illness. So maybe bipolar disorder, maybe or early schizophrenia. Yeah, absolutely, Dr. Disability. Ross. Mm-hmm. Yep. So we use them for that. And then the third category is, like you said, mitigation. So when a young person admits and says, yes, I am guilty of this offense or I committed this offense, then we have to go to what happens. What kind of treatment services does this young person need? And we use psychologists to make recommendations to the court because we know that when a young person has appropriate services, they oftentimes are really successful in the future.
Thank you for that breakdown in terms of the different areas and the stats that you also talked about in terms of Black young people, particularly Black young men being perceived as older. Yes, research also shows that from the age of 12, both Black boys and girls are seen as older. So even at 12, which is prepubescent, it's not even fully puberty as yet. So for girls, it may be viewed as more in a sexualized way. And then particularly with Black boys, it's more so violence. And what you talked about there earlier in terms of the age, it just makes me want to also highlight the school to prison pipeline. Yes. So school disciplinary policies that disproportionately affect Black students. So sometimes there are zero tolerance disciplines that is resulted in Black students facing disproportionate or harsher types of punishment than white students. So we have Black students that are suspended three times more and expelled three times more than white students. We also see that student suspension or being expelled also can lead to the juvenile justice system within just even the following year. So keeping in mind, once they are within the system now, it's a greater challenge in terms yep. of, you know, they're still developing. We know that the brain, the frontal lobe, is still developing up until age 21. So it's not fully online. So we have to keep that in mind. A 13, a 14-year-old, as you said, 10-year-olds, we hear it in the news. I can't remember the case, if it was maybe Florida. It was a 5 or 6-year-old who was likely just having a tantrum, and the child was taken out in handcuffs. So this is exactly. where we have to say, what is going on with our criminal justice system, in that there are these levels of inequity, and it's designed in this way. There's definitely better ways for us to deal with a 5 or 6-year-old that is having something that is developmentally appropriate, a tantrum. So we have exactly. to keep in mind, as you said, these are young people within the system, but at the same time, they aren't fully developed to understand what's going on. Okay. So as a public defender, how do you work to build equitable defense and advocate for your clients?
I think that's such a great question, Dr. Ross. And, you know, I've been doing this work for 12 years and I've learned a lot. And part of the biggest, I think, challenge is to close my mouth and listen. And I think that is the best thing for young people is providing that equitable defense, is listening. It's not my job to overpower that young person's story. And so many of the young people that we represent have never had the chance to tell their story. You know, it's so fitting that we had our podcast today, because on Friday we have a meeting with our two teams, our Kansas City and our St. Louis team, and we do celebrations of victories. And one of the lawyers was talking about a trial that she had with a young person this past week, and they won the trial. It was a great defense. And at the end of that trial, mm-hmm. yes, it was great. That Woo-hoo. Young person said, Dr. Ross, to his lawyer, thank you for listening to me. And she said that for the first time in her career, and she's been doing this for a while, she said it was really a crossroads for this young person, because he felt like, oh my gosh, somebody cared enough to listen to my story. And we call that in the defense world, we call that procedural due process, right? So there's due process, which is what you hear about in the Constitution, and everyone deserves the same sort of treatment in court. We know that doesn't happen often, but there's this other thing that's called procedural due process. And for young people, it's particularly important that when they feel like the process is fair and they feel like they had somebody fighting for them, that they are probably not going to come back into the system. And so that's, you know, I might not always win and we might not always win in court, but it's the whether my kid feels like we won. And I've had cases where the young person has not walked out of the courtroom with me, but they have said, thank you. I know you fought and I feel like you told my story and what I needed to say. So that's my answer for you.
I love that. Close my mouth and listen. But again, it highlights the mental health piece, right? So while you're not a therapist, you still have to be therapeutic and trauma informed in terms of working with your clients and having a level of cultural sensitivity, cultural humility, listening, understanding where they come from, understanding geographics, understanding their age, their socioeconomic status, their family backgrounds, all of those things intersecting, coming together to make them who they are. So it is so important, this combination of mental health and criminal justice. And unfortunately, we have so many hospitals in Missouri that have closed. And of course, it's not just a Missouri thing, it's throughout the nation, right? So we don't have as many places for acute care. We don't have as many places for long-term care. So there is a gap. And unfortunately, in some county jails, it becomes this revolving door. So mass incarceration is also another issue when we think about like substance issues, you know, their mental health challenges. Oftentimes it's trauma related. It's some form yes. of self-medicating. However, as you said, no one might have listened. There might not have been an opportunity to receive mental health care. And then those on treated mental health disorders, whether it's bipolar, schizophrenia, depression, whether it's unresolved trauma, that oftentimes can manifest behaviorally, right? Which you see in a lot with your clients, is what they call the ODD kit. You know, they're throwing stuff, they're hitting people, they're getting suspended from school. But what happened? What happened to them that is related to such intense behavior? And I've done a lot of that in foster care work, you know, being abandoned early on. We have sometimes in utero exposure, you know, to substances, which impacts brain development. So sometimes self-soothing is difficult for some children. Then we have being exposed to violence in the home, in the community. So not having appropriate conflict resolution skills. And oftentimes this may lead to offending behaviors.
Yes. And that fight or flight, Dr. Ross, you know what you're talking about, right? So you have these young people who are immersed in this trauma and have to constantly be on their guard. And then the adults in their world that aren't their caregivers are surprised when they're in fight or flight mode at school, right? Or in social situations. And you can't blame the young people for that.
No, and we have to understand, you know, we think about veterans. It was just, you know, recently 9/11. So we definitely remember all those who were lost at that time. We think about them and their families, the first responders, as well as military. So when we think about veterans, we understand combat, you know, going in a combat zone and coming back home and having to adjust. But for many of these young people, they're in combat zone. So they don't have to join the military. They don't have to go far away. There's urban trauma sometimes. There's trauma within the home, within the communities. And it does lead, as you said, to that fight or flight response. So now that is combined with the impulsivity of just being an adolescent. It might be intermingled now with substance use as a way to cope, but then that also impairs judgment and functioning. So it's all these different levels that aren't accounted for, that a lot of it is unresolved, untreated trauma.
Yes. And we treat, you know, we don't treat them as well as we should treat our veterans, but, you know, we recognize that when our veterans come home, they need to have access to appropriate mental health care, right? And we have an entire generation, probably many, many generations of young people and of adults who have been in war zones in our country, right?
Yes.
And exposed to that trauma and that, and they have PTSD. I can tell you, Dr. Ross, so many young people that I represent now have been diagnosed with PTSD. And that's just so sad and heartbreaking.
Yeah, so untreated, as we said, leads to offending behaviors at times. So where the psychology comes in is that we're not the law piece. We are describing what is the psychology of offending, what has led to the decision-making, the choices, the mental processes, the emotional processes that has led to the offending behavior. So in terms of your preparation for defense, working with clients from different socioeconomic and racial backgrounds, what do you feel are like some of the pillars in terms of what's important to keep in mind in terms of like cultural sensitivity and cultural competence?
You know, I heard a really, it's so interesting. I feel like so many things happen right before we were going to do this podcast, but I heard the term white centering. And I thought that was so interesting. Somebody said that they don't want something to be white centered. And I think that's so important as a blonde white woman representing many children of color in St. Louis City and the surrounding areas. I have to be really cognizant that, and really, it's really important to me that I do not put my judgment or what I think is best for the young person and their family. I think that's the number one pillar, Dr. Ross. And, you know, it's really hard a lot of times for people because they're like, well, these are young people. They shouldn't, you know, they're teenagers. They can't make their own decisions. And that's not how we operate. We operate on expressed interest. So if a young person says to me, Miss Sarah, I don't want you talking to my mom or my dad, my father is abusive towards me, I'm not going to talk to that person's mother or father. And that's really hard, but I have to honor what that child's experience was. And so I try to carry that with me also in understanding and trying to learn about people's, trying to be culturally competent, trying to understand people's socioeconomic backgrounds. I tell the kids all the time, you have to tell me your story. I don't understand it until you tell me what you need me to know. And so I think it just goes back to that listening piece, Dr. Ross, is trying to learn as much as I can and trying not to put my judgment or what I think would be best for that young person, substitute that for the young person. Sometimes I might think, hey, this kid is really traumatized and they shouldn't go back to the household that they were living in. But that's what they want to do. And so that's what I'm going to advocate for. And unless and until they tell me something different, that I am an expressed interest lawyer. So, and that's where it's also good to have other players in the system. Sometimes you have guardian ad litems who advocate for the best interest of a child, right? So that's in the care and protection system. But when we are in the juvenile delinquency or criminal realm, I am that expressed lawyer. So listening again, Dr. Ross, that listening.
And what you alluded to there again is implicit bias, right? Which is a big buzz right now, although it's been around for some years. It's just referring to unconscious attitudes, beliefs, stereotypes, and we all have biases. We just do. You know, to say we don't have biases, like say, well, I've never told a lie. Now everyone has told a lie at some point. Now it might not be in excess. It might be omission versus commission, but it has occurred. So implicit bias, it's important for us to understand that those are our blind spots. It's implicit because we don't understand. It's not conscious. So this is where having colleagues, consulting, doing trainings is helpful for us to understand what those blind spots are, because sometimes someone might be able to point it out to us, whereas we could not have understood it. We know what the explicit biases are. Those are the ones that are on that conscious level. And we know, okay, it's maybe a challenge for me to work with a particular population. So it's important, as you said, yes, to keep listening and also recognize, you know, there's going to be differences. So the fact that you're going into it recognizing that race, you know, may be something that makes a difference in terms of, is this client going to be able to trust you? Historical trauma, current traumas, you know, discrimination that has been experienced, it may be difficult for them to open up to you. So tell us a little bit more just about that aspect of cultural humility and building rapport with clients, particularly in a system that is so disproportionately, you know, Black and Brown in terms of incarceration. And then it's also disproportionately prosecution as well as defenders being white or not from a diverse background.
So Dr. Ross, I'll say, you know, I am on my own anti-racism journey. And I think that I have grown in places, and I certainly feel like I have a long way to go in others. So this, you know, certainly is not perfect by any means. But I think the first thing that I have always tried to do as a defender of youth is show them by my actions what I'm about. And when a young person says, Sarah, I need you to go talk to this witness, or can you advocate for me or ask me, you know, they won't say advocate. They'll say, will you ask me to go home with my grandmother? If I tell a young person I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. If I tell them I'm going to come see them on a particular day at a certain time, I'm going to do it. If I tell them I'm going to bring police reports so we can look over them, I will do it. So I try to show by my actions and by listening that I am somebody to be trusted. Also, young people need time and they need to understand that you're on their side. So we have in our children's defense team, a lot of times folks will bring a deck of cards and they will ask the young person if they want to play cards. And it's just a time to connect either silently or talking about something that doesn't matter or talking about a particular sport. So we try to connect not just in the legal way, but in the non-legal way, right? Teenager way. Hey, sometimes kids will be out on release and they will come in these awesome Nikes. And so I'll share the story. Oh my gosh, I have a family member that works for Nike. I like your Jordans, right? So trying to connect on a way that just recognizes we're all humans. And then, you know, Dr. Ross, speaking to the trauma piece, a lot of kids, you know, they have had, they're testing you to see, are you going to be just another adult?
Exactly.
That fails me, right? And so I try not to be that adult. So it does it work all the time? No. And is there distress? Yes, there should be, right? There should be. Hundreds and hundreds of years of slavery and racism and trauma, that of course there's going to be some distrust, and a lot of distrust. So I just try to do the best I can with every young person, meet them at where they are, and recognize that sometimes, that trust isn't always going to be there, but if I can listen and do my best, hopefully we'll get to a result that everybody's happy with.
As you mentioned, there being a person of your word, right? Just integrity. Your word is your bond. And that is so important in trauma work. So not only for attorneys, for mental health professionals, counselors, whatever background you might be from, if it's parents that are adopting or fostering, working with children who have experienced trauma, that is so important. Because sometimes people learn by words. You can say something and they believe you. But oftentimes that happens when there has been a stable environment and upbringing. Right. As you said, a person said they will pick you up at this time, they pick you up at that time. If they ever don't, it's very rare because mom or dad or grandma or whoever is on time. But when there is that constant instability early in life, it becomes difficult to trust. So no matter what an adult may say, within themselves, they're like, yeah.
Exactly.
Wait for it. Give it time, because this is what everyone says or does. And I think it's important for us to know that we don't have to necessarily prove ourselves. We don't have to make a case to them. As you said, it's just being present. It's being mindful. It's being aware. It's listening, as you said, being connected and being authentic. Authenticity is important, because when an individual has experienced trauma early in their life, they are highly aware emotionally, they're sensitive, and they can pick up when people yes. are genuine or not. So as long as we are being authentic and we can recognize our limits, yep. you know, our weaknesses and our strengths, I think they can roll with that. But when we try to be more than we are or do more than we can do, I think that becomes a challenge. And we've talked about that in the past, the importance of not overpromising. So tell us a little bit about that as an attorney, as a public defender. Why is it important not to overpromise to your client?
So, yes, that's a great question. So, you know, an example of overpromising would be to tell a young person. So when a young person is initially detained or taken into custody, there has to be a hearing within 3 days. And the court decides, is that young person going to go home or are they going to stay in the detention center? Overpromising to a young person would be like, oh, yeah, you're going to get out. I promise. It's, you know, we got this. We don't know what the judge is going to say. We don't know what the prosecutor is going to say. We don't know sometimes what a young person's parent or guardian is going to say. So what we do in those scenarios is we have to sit down with that young person and talk through what are all the options. And I always tell my young people, look, I am always going to be honest with you. It might not be the best answer or the answer that you want to hear, but I'm never going to tell you something's going to happen if it doesn't. Because Dr. Ross, you and I both know you overpromise the first time and then the trust is gone, right? You're done.
Out the window. It's
right. Exactly.
It's done.
Yes. Yes. Or if like probation, let's say you're advocating for a young person, they've admitted, okay, you know, I did this, you know, offense, and you say, oh, I promise that you're going to get out and here are your conditions. No worries. Well, that again, that might not be the case. And so you really have to be intentional about what you express to the young people, because they so desperately want to believe you and they so desperately want to go home, right? I mean, that is number one on most young people's priority list. So if you overpromise that and that doesn't happen, you're in trouble.
And then even within the system, there are just certain facts that are there that are true. It's an inequitable system. We have same crimes different times. We have percentage differences in sentence length for Black men versus white men with similar backgrounds who commit the same crimes. So we have to keep in mind overpromising for that reason. When we think of the structure and the system within itself, there is definitely a chance that things may not go the way that you would hope for it to go.
Exactly.
with your client. So having those conversations become important. So how would you advise or how can public defenders begin to advocate for obtaining and contracting experts from diverse backgrounds with specialty in diversity, equity, and inclusion? I know you do a great job. You are an ally. Woo-woo, Sarah, she walks the walk and talks the talk in terms of trying to get her experts from diverse communities. How would you encourage others who may be having a challenge or they feel stuck? What would you tell them?
So I will say, you know, Dr. Ross, you have certainly helped open, you know, the lines of communication. I can't say enough about how different our clients feel when they feel like they have an expert or somebody that is from the same background and looks like them. How many young people have opened up and given additional information? I think that's just, it's just huge. It is case changing, outcome changing. We have an amazing juvenile defense community, not just in Missouri, but nationwide. So I think my first suggestion would be to reach out to your local defender. You know, reach out to myself. I'm happy to provide my contact information and we can begin to brainstorm. Because when we can start to tell the story of the young person from a culturally competent lens, the outcomes are amazing. And, you know, we had recently had a hearing with one of your colleagues, Dr. Ross, that you suggested, and the story that she told and the picture that she painted, the judge mm-hmm. afterwards, you know, the outcome wasn't what we wanted, but the judge said to me after, thank you so much for educating me on urban mental health. I didn't even know that this was something that existed until your expert testified today. It's 2021. We should, you know, mm-hmm. urban mental health, right? I mean, it's amazing, but that really, it's true. I mean, it really, we need to continue to push and advocate yes. for diverse experts. And I think the outcomes are going to be better because we have people who understand so many more. I don't know. I don't even know what I'm trying to say. I'm so excited, Dr. Ross, but it's so important. It's so important. I can't say enough about it.
So that is from the local level. So part of what you said, reach out to your local defender. So some of what, you know, can be done if it's not being done is just training, right? Training.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Within offices in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, implicit bias, yes. culturally sensitive training, urban trauma, community yes. violence, racial trauma, intergenerational trauma, ACEs, and all of those intersecting areas, socioeconomics, and how all of that interplays, intersects, and yes. can contribute to offending behaviors, poverty. You know, you talked about anti-racist work, which is important, and so is anti-poverty because they're interwoven, because unfortunately, people of color are disproportionately in poverty. And part of that is because of history. When we think about slavery, we think about colonization, we think about forced labor for free for generations. So we know that those inequities are there. So there's a difference between what is equitable and what is liberating. So we have to keep that in mind. Those are things that can be done. Yes. And you all do a great job in your office with that. We also want to see that happening on the level of prosecutors as well as with judges. So in terms of the full system being exposed to this type of work. So that is from the level of your working with fellow public defenders and colleagues. What would you say to families? So if someone is listening now and they have a young person who is within the criminal justice system, what would you advise to them to help them to make sure that their public defender is doing all that they can, that they are advocating for them and working to have as much equitable you know, representation, or as you called it, procedural due process?
Wow. So that's a great question. So I think, you know, one of the things that we're really lucky about in the St. Louis area is that we have something called participatory defense. And participatory defense, it's run by Metropolitan Congregations United. And if you look on their website, you can find them. They're an organization that helps rally around and wrap their arms around families and youth who are involved in the juvenile system. Now, they don't provide representation, but they collaborate with us defense lawyers in helping gather information, gather stories, gather letters, and they help kind of navigate that system because the system is very confusing. It's confusing. It's hard. It's scary, right? For the first time for many of these families, they're trying to navigate it. There are negative perceptions about public defenders. And so you think, oh, I'm not going to call my public defender. They won't care. But the number one piece of advice I can give is to call the attorney. They care about your kid. They care about your young person. They want to help. They want to ensure that we do the best job that we can. So that communication is huge. And if there is a breakdown in that communication, I am always here. We have in all of our public defender offices, a juvenile specialist. So somebody who specializes in juvenile work, but that's not their primary area of work. And so we try to interface with all of the lawyers in those jurisdictions and provide help, but we're always willing to have conversations with youth and families and do better. We can always do better. We have, everyone has a lot of work on their plate. So part of my job is to, make sure that each family and each child feels like they are represented to the best of their ability. So if you're having communication issues, again, please reach out to me and I'm happy to help, you know, open those lanes of dialogue and jump in if necessary.
Now you did say talk to your public defender. So it's important for us to also discuss now cultural stigma, you know, within communities. And it's there for a reason, because historically, people could have been killed, lynched, harmed, children taken out of the home for sharing with someone that was outside of their home or outside of their community. So what we have to keep in mind is that some of these, and that's part of what I train on, they're culturally adaptive behaviors when under certain levels of stress. So similar to like the soldier who is in the war zone, it makes sense to have the fight or flight going because it could mean life or death for them. However, when they come home and they're adjusting, they don't need to be on that level of alert. So similarly, when we think culturally in the community, there's a lot of racial profiling, discrimination, being harassed by the police. Some people have been, you know, beaten by the police. And, you know, I had a colleague, a white colleague told me that one time that I can't remember the case, the one in Minnesota. I can't recall his name. If you recall his name, Castillo, maybe.
Oh, yes.
That was shot in front of his fiance and the child was in the car. And he said that opened his eyes to things because he always assumed that something wrong was happening. Like that person had to have done something if the police pulled them over or, you know, something was happening. He didn't understand the concept of harassment, and understandably, because being a privileged person, his mind just couldn't wrap around that. But the fact that that happened, he was shocked. And the fact that the woman stayed so calm at the time. And again, it's honing in on those senses that it becomes a matter of survival. She saw what happened. Now she had to keep herself alive and her child alive. But these are the talks that oftentimes parents have with children of color. If you get pulled over by the police, keep your hands where they can be seen. Don't make any sudden movements. Yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. Because we understand that sometimes bias occurs. That implicit bias that Black equals criminal, Black equals unsafe, you know, something could happen to me. I could be harmed. I could be killed. And I understand it may not be an easy job to be a police officer. So it's not an anti-police thing, but it is recognizing that, you know, those who are trained in implicit bias, communities that have more police of color, we see lower numbers of unjustified type of shootings and killings of Black and brown people. So when you say talk to the public defender, I hear what you're saying. But keep it in mind, that racial trauma piece is like, I'm not talking to that lady. I'm not talking to that man. I don't know what's going to happen. So some of that is just going to take time. But this is where having real conversations and acknowledging, yes, the system isn't always just. Yes, discrimination happens. Historical trauma is real. Current manifestations of things. We don't have lynchings in the form of ropes now, but we have, you know, brutality and other things that are happening in the community. So when you have these real conversations, it's not that it will magically open the door, but it starts to build.
You're exactly right.
A little bit at a time. So yes,
you're exactly right.
Tell them to talk to their public defender, but also public defenders recognize that that may not happen very quickly. It's going to take time. And if you have expert witness test experts from different backgrounds, those can be also your collaborators, the people that you work with to help to try to build and be that bridge.
Yes. And the participatory defense people too, Dr. Ross, I mean, those are their community members, who folks who live in the communities that our families live in, and also previously system involved parents and youth. And so it is not, I have not gone to one participatory defense meeting. That is a community led meeting. And so I think you're exactly right. Bridging that gap and bridging that distrust. And there has been, and there will continue to be. And hopefully, like you said, you start to break down those barriers by not talking the talk, but walking the walk.
And participatory defense, that is here in Missouri, but that is something that not every state has. Can you talk a little bit about that, just to educate, because we'll have listeners that are in different states? So national, is it a national thing or varies by state?
Yeah, so it's a national movement. It's not in every state, but started in California. It moved to the East Coast. I think it's in New York. I know it's in Tennessee. So it is a movement. It really started in California, and they have a specific training model. It's quite amazing. And it really has also created some policy shifts too, in the legislatures across our country. So it really is amazing. People have been exonerated because of the evidence that has been brought forth by communities, and, you know, finding a video or finding, you know, a witness that the defender was not able to find. So it really is quite a unique piece of the community, you know, and when a community is wrapping their arms around that family and young person, again, those outcomes are amazing. And the courts are listening, right? Because you've got pastors, you've got family members, you've got educators who are coming forth and saying, hey, this young person shouldn't go to the adult system, or this young person shouldn't go to prison, or this young person shouldn't be placed outside of their home. So yeah, we just have started it here in Missouri. It's been around for maybe a year and a half or so. And so we're excited to see where it goes.
Wonderful. So that's a tidbit. You know, listeners are in different parts of the nation and world. So look into that if that's something that is near you. I want to go back a little bit to what you talked about, that you've been on your own anti-racist journey, and just saying woo woo for you with that. And also encouraging that we have to recognize, what does it mean to be anti-racist? And this is a process of actively identifying and opposing racism. So sometimes you will hear people say, oh, I'm not racist. But what anti-racism is explaining that even if someone is saying they're not racist, if a person is not working towards opposing racism, then it falls into the racism category. And I know it's tough for some people to hear that, because the R word makes people nervous. They get offensive, all kinds of stuff. But I think part of that is thinking about racism in an antiquated way, thinking about it from the antebellum time. And what we have to realize that it's a modern structure and system of racism now that is different. So while we don't have, you know, lynching may happen sometimes in the way that it did in the past, but we have more modern type of issues. We have mass incarceration. We have racial profiling. We have police brutality. We have significant violence within communities that are poverty-based. So these are more of the structural aspects of racism. So when we say we're not racist, if we aren't engaging in opposing the system, meaning what can you do to oppose racism in some systemic kind of way, then we fall into, if we're not a part of the solution, we're a part of the problem. So there's a lot of work that individuals can do in terms of learning about allyship, you know, not just being a bystander. So if we stand by and we say, oh, I'm not being racist, but we're not doing any actionable work, that becomes problematic. So I'm happy to hear you talk about that and encourage other attorneys, defenders, and whatever kind of work we do to be anti-racist.
Amen to that. Amen. And it's a journey, right? I mean, I think there are, it's hard when you are a defender not to feel like a cog in the system, Dr. Ross, you know, because sometimes you don't win. And sometimes your clients go to prison or go to out of home facilities. And so, you know, just trying to push back. And also, I think one of the things, just a side note really quickly, I realized something that I needed to work on was ensuring that when I had conversations with my young people about trauma, part of that is understanding that you can't just have a conversation about trauma and then walk out the door. That's racist. That's me not recognizing that what is happening to this young person, this trauma, all of these things. I can't just have a conversation and then not think that there are going to be other impacts afterwards. So we really need to be intentional about every single interaction that we have. So yes, I appreciate that. I have a long way to go, but I'm trying, and it's collaborating with experts like yourself that help us push that ball forward.
So we've talked about a lot of things today. We've talked about diversity, equity and inclusion, equitable care. You've talked about procedural due process. We've learned a great bit. Could you just tell us a little bit more, any tidbits in terms of the work you've done with clients specifically who experienced racial trauma? And racial trauma can be discrimination, racial profiling, microaggressions, where it might be more subtle. It could be hate crimes in the terms of like some types of physical assault. In working with individuals with racial trauma, tell us a little bit about
Oh, I mean, that's a big thing to unpack, Dr. Ross. I think every single young person that I've represented has had some form of racial trauma. I really, from school to prison pipeline, right? Mm-hmm. So from young people to being pushed out of schools for acts that their white counterparts would not have been, they would have been treated differently, right? It might have been a school suspension or just a slap on the wrist. You know, they've got school, we've got the socioeconomic trauma, right, mm-hmm. of young people. I think about a young man who was accused of a robbery. And when trying to figure out, like, why, you know, what happened, we found out that the family didn't have food, you know, so mm-hmm. you know, the trauma of not having food. And then we've got the policing piece, right? So I've had young people who have been beaten. I've had young people who have lost teeth because they've had their teeth knocked out by police. I've had people be called names that no individual should be called. So yes, the traumas are multi-layered. And so it is difficult to, you know, again, we talk about that. What does that unpacking that trauma look like with mm-hmm. that young person? And do they want to relive it? Some kids do not want to talk mm-hmm. about it. And I have to honor that. Even if it would help further our defense or our story in front of the court, if they don't want to talk about it, we have to honor that. And we have to honor that, you know, maybe at some point they'll be able to share with somebody that they feel safe with. So yes, every single child has experienced racial trauma.
And what you said there in terms of they may not want to unpack it, that's where the experts come in again. We've talked about PTSD on previous shows, but recognizing avoidance is literally one of the criterion of PTSD, avoiding people, yes, places, and things that are reminders of the trauma. So it isn't, I just don't want to talk about this, or, you know, they're apathetic, or, you know, they're ignoring it, they don't really care, or they're not concerned, because sometimes that may be the perception from, right, the prosecution. It's recognizing that this is literally symptomatic and indicative of post-traumatic stress disorder. And what we've understood with time now, research, you know, science, a lot of the literature shows us that talking about it is important, but it's having a safe space to, yes, talk about it and to heal, because if a person never addresses it, then, you know, they may not be ever able to heal from it, because there's no way to come through it but to go through it. So it's that challenge. So as you said, as an attorney, it's not your job to push them or force them to talk about it. However, therapeutically working with the expert, it might be helping them to get to a point, because that may help their defense, right?
Yes. Oh, exactly.
To discuss history, what has happened, what contributed to the decisions that were made. They may have been abused in the past. And when someone came up close to them, that fight or flight, it just kicked into gear, and they, exactly, acted before they could think, because they just went into that fight or flight and they needed to keep themselves safe.
Yes.
So we'll definitely have to have you back, because as you said, it's a lot to unpack, but this is very much a great start for us to just think about trauma-informed care, that intersection between criminal justice and mental health, and doing as much as we can to advocate. So we have had a remarkably wonderful dialogue with attorney Sarah Johnson, and we certainly thank you for joining us on New Horizon Mind and Body Connection. If people want to reach out, how can they contact you?
So Dr. Ross, first of all, thank you so much. It's always so great to have conversations with you. You are just so inspiring. So thank you.
I love talking
with you. Second, so the easiest way to find me is on our Missouri State Public Defender website. And if you go to mspd.mo.gov and look for offices and contacts, I am the number one contact, because our office is the first district to the Children's Defense Team. So Sarah Johnson, if you look there, you can find my email and phone number, and I am easily accessible. So please reach out.
So mspd.mo.gov, and you are the first contact, Sarah Johnson. So we have just a couple of minutes left. So I know we've talked a lot today. So any nuggets, if you had to just pack it into that 1 to 2 minute, what would you really like listeners to take from today in terms of the intersection of criminal justice and mental health?
It is such it's a cutting edge frontier. It is so interesting and exciting. And I ask that, you know, next time you see a news story about a 15 or 16 year old charged with a really serious offense, take a moment before you make a judgment call and think about, oh, I wonder what sort of psychological or adolescent brain development issues are present in that young person's case. It might not excuse all of the conduct, but it certainly might give you a lens with which to view that person's case.
Definitely. And that's challenging ourselves, right? To get outside of our comfort zone, because it may be in bias. We hear something and we make an assumption. And part of what you talked about there is those mitigating factors. Again, it's not that it's excusing a behavior. We acknowledge that offending behavior happens. However, what is going to be the best course of action? And as you've mentioned before, we have many young people being tried as adults, many of them being detained in centers that have adults. So a big part of what we should challenge ourselves is that the correct setting? Is this, you know, the proper type of charge? Yes, there needs to be some kind of response, but but what is going to be the best response in those cases?
Exactly. And Dr. Ross, I put the correct email address in the chat. So
wonderful.
It's there for everybody.
So thank you again, Attorney Johnson. It's always a pleasure talking with you, working with you. Thank you for all that you do for advocating for our young people. We want this to catch fire, that more people are having this trauma-informed and DEI lens. We thank you for being on New Horizon, the Mind and Body Connection. Thank you to all of our listeners. And our next show will be on September 26th. Thank you so much. Remember, a healthy mind and healthy body is key to longevity. Take care. You are